Right, next up on the programme, we're going to hear the story of a former hurler paralysed by life-changing spinal injuries in a match, who's been inspired to walk again by his baby son. And the story itself is an inspiration, and that's why we wanted to share it with you. The man in question is Desi Fitzgerald. Desi, a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us on the programme. First, Desi, I know it's probably difficult to reflect on it, but for the benefit of those who don't know, can you tell us briefly your story?
Yeah, of course I can, yeah. Look, my younger brother Mike, and it was August 2011, he took his own life for reasons unknown to us, you know, it was completely out of the blue. And we were all in shock, obviously, after that. We were a very close family. And for me personally, you know, in a way I kind of dealt with it by immersing myself in sport. So, look, we had championship games after that and stuff. So I continued on playing. And we had a county semi-final. We were playing not too far away from my home club here. And I dived in for a tackle in the game. It was probably about 10 minutes before halftime. And I collided between two players. I got two knees into the chest. And at that point, you know, I was in a complete daze for about 10 seconds. But after I came out of the daze, I realised that I couldn't feel or move anything from below the shoulders down, which was an unbelievable shock, as you can imagine.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. It sounds like a lot of people's worst nightmares. At that stage, though, what was going through your head? Did you think that this was just temporary, or were you aware that this could be something much more serious in that moment?
I didn't fully understand. I suppose it took me a while to... it probably took me about 5 minutes to try and get my head around and go. And I was surrounded at this stage. You know, luckily, there was two nurses on the sideline that came over, and I think they kind of realised the seriousness of it straight away when they realised I couldn't move, and they made sure that no one went anywhere near me. Thanks be to God, because if I was moved at all, you know, I would have been completely paralysed from that point on.
It wouldn't be unusual for an opposition player or even one of your teammates to throw a hand down and sort of say, come on, get up, you'll be all right. So you're lucky that didn't happen.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that happens so quickly, and you know, you look in all sports. So those are, look, come on, lift him over to the sideline, give him some water, and he'll be fine, you know. But thankfully, they pushed everyone back in. Before I knew it, I was surrounded by loads of people, and my fiance Sarah, she was down on her two knees outside me, and my mum and dad were there as well, and my brother was actually playing in the same day as well. So, like, after 5 minutes. And I, you know, had no sense. The nurses were asking me if any sensation, can you move anything at all? And I started to get a little bit of a panic attack, but I didn't let it take over because I had so many people surrounding me, kind of telling me, look, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay. So I tried to, I just tried to take that in as much as I could. And then after maybe 20 minutes or so, the ambulance arrived and I was put onto, they put on a neck brace on me straight away and put me onto a stretcher. And
it turns out you had a very rare injury in hurling, a spinal cord syndrome.
Central spinal cord syndrome, yeah. So it's where I got the MRI scan in Dublin in the matter, and so the doctors came in and they said I had a bleed right in the centre of my spinal cord from the impact, and around it then it was severely bruised and there was swelling and stuff, and I fractured C4 as well. But hey, look, it's unheard of. And in hurling, you know, you'd hear about, I think, American football is the most common place where an injury like this can happen, with central spinal cord syndrome.
At that early stage, what was the prognosis, Desi?
I didn't know. The doctor that came in initially, he said that, look, I don't know if you're going to move or not from the shoulders down. I said, it's not a complete injury, is what he said. So thankfully, it was an incomplete injury, but the incomplete injuries lying with the bleed where it was. They didn't know what signals were going to make their way down to, you know, to any part of below my neck. From that point on. But as soon as he said, look, you may move again, I kind of latched on to that word. And I was in the bed, I didn't move for the first whatever it was.
Because you're conditioned to prepare your body, you're conditioned for performances, you're conditioned for a date in the future. And I presume you were able to draw on that to some extent to say, look, the doctor's not saying this is a no.
Exactly. Exactly. And look, I think I would have had that attitude in looking at life in general beforehand, you know, and sport would have helped a lot as well in relation to that. So as soon as he says, look, it's not complete, straight away I was like, I had visions in my head of just moving again, no matter what it was.
And we'll talk more about how that developed. But unthinkably, at around this time, you also lost your younger brother, James.
I was in hospital for a year, and I came home almost a year. I came home in August, and the following, you know, I couldn't get my head around it. I was, you know, I had very little mobility, and I came home the August, and the following October, my younger brother James, he went to work out in the gym, you know, another keen sports player, and he was doing a workout, and halfway through, he collapsed, and he died of that sudden adult death syndrome, which was, look, just unimaginable. We thought, you would imagine, we went through enough at that point, but
just devastating.
Oh, just like,
you must, you know, have an amazingly strong family, Desi, or support group.
Unbelievable. I mean, my family are just absolutely amazing. Their strength is just like, from through the whole thing, from my brother Mike passing away initially, then for me, from during the accident, you know, my wife, they just stood by my bedside, you know, encouraging me, you know, they were so, so strong. And look, we'd always be very close, our family, and with Sarah's family as well. And I've the support of the community around, you know, the community around here has just been truly amazing. And you know what, it's the community around Ireland, since the accident happened. I mean, the letters I've been getting from everywhere, including many a letter I got from people in Donegal, which was just amazing. And that kind of, you know, that inspired me in a way as well to stay strong for myself and to keep going.
And one person that really, really stayed strong for you was your then fiance, and you've mentioned her already, Sarah, because this changed your life, but it also changed hers.
Of course it did. I mean, Sarah turned into my carer, so she did, which was, you know, which is unbelievable, really. You know, what a tough job for anyone. I mean, to go, for me, I was fully able-bodied, you know, doing everything for myself, fully independent, and then to go to the exact opposite extreme, and for Sarah to have to do everything for me, you know, she was just a powerful, amazing woman to stay by my side and just to have that constant support. I mean, that's what got me. That's what's after getting me to where I am today, for sure.
And then you were blessed with the arrival of little MJ.
Yeah. He's 4 months and 2 weeks old now, but an absolute blessing. Because, look, it was something I was conscious of after the accident myself, you know, would I be able to have kids again? But thankfully, that all worked out for us. And, yeah, look, his arrival into the world has just been amazing, you know. He's made our house an actual home here, which is brilliant, look, and brilliant for my family and Sarah's family as well, as you can imagine.
And since the accident, you have shown signs of improvement. I know that there was a very special moment as you were getting married that you were able to get up onto your feet, which was one of the targets you set. But MJ seems to have spurred you on even further.
Of course, yeah, definitely. Look, I mean, the gains, I'm in constant therapy. I'm in therapy 5 days every week. To, you know, look at the spinal cord injury, there's so much involved. Every part of my body shut down, internal organs as well. So it's just a constant work in progress. And look, I've stayed at it since I left home. I've stayed at it for the last 4 years. And look, yes, definitely, MJ's arriving into the world has given me, you know, further drive to keep pushing even further, to be able to do as much as I possibly can for myself and for him and Sarah, you know, because I want to be able to do as much as I can for them, because at the moment, you know, I'm very limited in what I can do for myself and also for them. But he's definitely a big drive for me to keep going.
It must be encouraging for you, Desi, though, that when you do put in the effort, which you are continuously, albeit there may be what we might see as little rewards, little improvements, but for you, they must be huge each time you're able to just, you know, do something a little bit more different or get a little bit closer to your aim and goal.
Oh, massively so, massively so. I mean, the goals for me beforehand would have been, you know, out in the hurling field. The goals for me now were to get back to small, simple tasks. You know, I remember, like, a big thing for me was to be able to lift a bin bag at one point. You know, I remember the joy, or, you know, just be able to make myself breakfast, or to be able to put dinner together. So, you know, very simple tasks like that. Even at one point, it was to get brushing my teeth and to be able to shave myself. You know, it's all gradual. You know, for me, it's all very gradual, but I can see differences each time. And yeah, people outside maybe may not be able to see it, but Sarah and I can see it because I can do so much more for myself.
You'd be perfectly within your rights now to wrap wee MJ up in cotton wool as he gets older and sort of say, you know, look what happened to me. Stay away from the GAA, this, that and the other. But that's certainly not the way you're going to be going, is it?
No, definitely not. Look, GAA was, I have got so much from GAA all the way through, you know, childhood into adulthood. You know, it's given me so much. I've met so many friends from it, and definitely not for him. I would be encouraging him to get involved in GAA. Because look, what happened to me was a freak accident, but there's so many benefits from it that, no, definitely, I'll be definitely encouraging. Hopefully myself be involved with him someday at a coaching level.
And the amazing thing about the GAA, though, and the part it plays in our society is that it wants to give back to you as well. And we also wanted to speak to you, Desi, to raise awareness of the fund that's been set up, the Desi Fitzgerald Injury Fund, officially launched in the Charleville GAA Club this month. And people can donate if they want at www.desifitzgerald.com. There's a Twitter account at DFITS Injury Fund, which we'll link all these on our website as well. That's the great thing, another great thing about the GAA, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the GAA and GAA community have just been amazing since all this has started. You know, they're the reason why I am where I am today, that I can do so much because I've been able to go to all these treatments. And yeah, look, when you see something like this happen, and to see the support that surrounds you, I've been involved with the GAA community. It's overwhelming, to be quite honest. You know, I didn't expect half of the support after the accident happened. And look, I will be forever grateful, and forever grateful for anyone that can look donate online in any way at all. And I have to say, look, everything raised, I have nothing to do with the account. It's managed by trustees, and it goes completely for rehabilitation. I have nothing to do with it. So
no, I know that, and that's why I wanted to mention it, Desi, because I thought you might be too modest to mention it yourself. But I'm going to do that. We're going to link it on all of our social media here as well. It's a truly inspirational story, Desi, and you're a very inspirational person. I hope you don't think it's patronising me saying that to you, but we really do appreciate you sharing your story with us, and hopefully you'll pass on our best regards to Sarah and MJ, and of course we send on our best wishes for you as you continue the road to recovery.
Thank you very, very much, and it's been a pleasure to be on. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Desi.
Take care.
But I'm very excited now to welcome into the studio Joel Harkin, who's a singer-songwriter from Letterkenny. Joel, thanks so much for coming in.
Hello.
Bit of a handling we had, didn't we?
Aye, it was touch and go there.
Because you employ technology a lot in your music, don't you?
Aye.
Not to process it, but in how you support yourself and how you back yourself. Tell us a little bit about the rig that you have.
Well, I've got an old Behringer interface here with Midas pickups or preamps in the front of it. It's a queer job. That's going into my laptop. So I feed my mic, my microphone, my guitar into the laptop to affect the... Well, just add effects to them and play with it, and then that's going back out through the box.
Now, you do have a special sound, which we're going to hear, of course, which we're looking forward to. How did you craft that, or how did you come up with, this is the style that I want to be going forward with, at least for the time being?
It wasn't really, I want, like, sitting down saying, oh, I want to do this, I'm going to go and do this now. It was a case of the track that I'm going to play for you was originally a remix of one of my friend's songs. That I did just for a college project, and I just was really happy with it, and I was like, here, can I write lyrics and guitar for this and play it as a song? And he was like, aye, that'll do, but give me a couple of those Haribos, and that was the trade-off.
Okay, like, very good. Now, we're all heading to Swell, it seems.
Yes, boy.
Everyone's going. You're looking forward to that. You're busy, aren't you? It's not just your own gig that you're doing.
No, I'm playing backup, lead guitar and backing vocals for my friend's band, Gabriel Pascal Blake.
Mm-hmm.
Queer crack.
Yeah, but your own stuff. What are you going to be doing?
Oh, I'm going to be doing the electronic set. I'm not going to be doing any of the acoustic stuff. I got on the main stage, so it was like, right, let's go for a bigger sound and some nice, lovely 50 hertz bass tones in there.
Excellent, brilliant. So you'll be able to rock it right out, as they say.
Hopefully so. Well, it'll be pretty chilled as well, like, but hopefully kind of dreamy. But
Now, tell us about what your set's going to entail. I'm going to ask you that question because it's an easier way of asking, you know, what stuff you like to play, that type, you know what I mean?
So, yeah,
like, how will you see your play set going when you're over at Swell, for instance?
How will I see it going?
Well, what are you playing?
I'm playing my own stuff. I'm playing a couple of songs that were on my first CD, which was mostly acoustic, like the single off at Meredith.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like an acoustic folk song, but I've reworked it to work in with a new set, and now it's kind of minimal techno, which was kind of strange, but so that's cool. And then I do a couple of covers and everything like that there as well. So.
And do you like to talk about influences? Do you have people that you feel have influenced your sound, your style?
Yeah, mostly like in the last year, Kathmandu from Derry. He was in my course with me in Northwest Regional, and he I was just playing acoustic music and, you know, kind of getting into a little bit more electronic stuff because I was doing a production course. But then he was there and he was making what he calls trip glitch hop lo-fi glo-fi twinkly music, and it's just like intelligent dance music. It's not for clubs, it's just to like listen to and appreciate.
Yeah,
kind of like going from swing to like bebop and jazz. It's kind of like, I don't know, happy hardcore to this.
Yeah. I'm a big fan myself of sort of genres and crossovers and, you know, different takes on different types of music. And is that where you're at as well? Like, do you sort of think, well, you talked about having an acoustic song and then, you know, reworking it to fit in with your digital music side of things.
Yeah. Well, like, going to create a track now, it's never a case of, oh, I'm going to do it in this genre. I do have some, like, go-to sounds that I really like. I really like a reverb-y electric guitar sound, so I use that in a lot of things, but that doesn't, like, completely influence the track. Like when I sit down to make a new track, it's a case of just playing with things and experimenting a little bit and see what happens. So whatever genre comes out of that, that's just kind of the way it is.
Cool. Now, what are you going to perform for us?
I'm going to play the song. There was a remix that I wrote lyrics for then and some guitar. And
this is one of your first times on radio too, is it?
Aye.
That's brilliant. Other than Swell, are you gigging around the place that people maybe can catch your work?
I've literally just decided that I'm not taking... maybe if they were handy and close by, but no, like, proper gigs, because I'm working on the album at the minute and it's gigging was taking up too much time.
You don't want to split your focus too much, really.
Exactly. You know? I want to get the album finished and out there before I properly start going gigging again.
How are you releasing the album?
I haven't really...
Cross that bridge when you come.
No, I'm gonna get the music sorted first, and then once that's out of mind, I'll think of probably through Bandcamp and Spotify.
And is it flowing well for you, your creativity?
Pretty much. I started using Ableton, and it's a digital audio workstation that's kind of laid out more for live use, and like,
right,
you just create a loop and then build on that loop and build on that loop and change it. Whereas like coming from Logic, which is what I use now, which is just like tape reel.
Yes.
It's that's linear thing. This is up and down.
And you can layer it and...
Yeah. You can still do it in Logic, but just being creative is a lot easier in Ableton, so I'm still getting my head around it, but it's really working out for me.
Right. Well, get off that mic and onto your proper mic, as they say. And we look forward to... Well, I look forward to catching you at the Swell Festival on Aran Mór. This is Joel Harkin from Letterkenny, a really talented singer-songwriter, and he's going to be singing his own track for us. All right, take it away, Joel, when you're ready.
Well, there's some people I'd like to speak to. If they don't know it's me that's speaking, so come on over up the stairs. Well, here we are free. Well, no one cares. spark. We spend the daylight in the dark. And teeth sink like ships in the seas of your skin, ready to burn up just light a flame. Slipping so softly, so quiet, like nothing, clear as life in translucence. And by that so crisp, it put crunching the leaves, left the sky in a million shades. A palette of pastel synthetic surroundings and sights that were even dazed. We dirty our clothes, sorting Fanta from Coke. We've got no money, we've just got a design. Become trapped in an order of nothing for water, with ice cubes and lemon and lime.
Listen on out there. You can add me on Snapchat, Joel Harkin, Instagram at Joel Harkin, Twitter at Joel Harkin, and Joel Harkin Music on Facebook. Thanks a million for having me, Highland Radio.
Excellent. Real something different, Joel. That sounded great.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme. This, of course, is the weekend edition here on Highland Radio. Geraldine Herbert is the excellent motoring journalist with the Indo, Motoring Wheels for Women and Irish Country Magazine. And you're very welcome back onto the show, Geraldine.
Morning, Greg.
How are you?
I'm grand. How are you?
I'm fine. Now, initially, we want to talk about this new electric car. Tell us a bit about it, Geraldine.
Yeah, this has just sort of emerged out of nowhere, and it's a crowd in Louth who are actually building their own electric car. Now, it's a long time since Ireland actually produced any sort of a car like this, so it sounds interesting. The kind of angle they're going for is they're making it ultra-light. So they reckon it'll be about 30% lighter than any sort of similar-sized car. So as a result, it'll have a range of 250 kilometres, because obviously with electric cars, the lighter they are, the better, and it means the battery will last a bit longer. So the range they're looking at is about 250 kilometres, and it'll go 0 to 100 in 10 seconds. So it certainly will be no slouch.
Indeed. And that range perhaps brings it into an area whereby people might say, you know, that's perhaps a realistic prospect.
Yeah, I wonder, though, how much range actually determines whether or not people are put off by electric cars. I think, you know, it's just, I think people need to get into electric cars. We need to see more of them on the road. It's this sort of catch-22, because if you actually talk to most people how many miles they are, how many kilometres they actually cover in a day, a lot of people don't do a huge distance. Like, the average, I think, driver does 18,000 kilometres a year. If you work that out, it's not a huge amount every week. So most people actually are within the range of an electric car, but they still feel that they don't want to just, you know, they don't want a car that they have to recharge every night, or they have to charge when they go into work, or maybe they don't have a charging point in work. So I'm not 100% convinced range is really the issue. I think price is a big thing with electric cars at the moment.
And I think the industry has to do some positive PR on it, because you talk to people about electric cars, they probably just said what I did about range, batteries, they cost a fortune, you have to replace the batteries after a certain amount of time, blah, blah, blah. Whereas you don't get the same conversation with diesel and petrol cars.
No, not at all. And it's funny, another thing that, I mean, we've had, we've had the Nissan Leaf, and we've had these specifically built electric cars on the road, and people said, oh, but when they look a bit more normal, and, you know, you can buy an electric Volkswagen Golf or an electric Ford Focus, that will make the difference. I recently tested the Volkswagen Golf, and it looks exactly like a normal Golf, so it does very little actually to promote the cause for electric cars in some way. I actually went into Tesco's and went to plug it in the electric charging point there, and a Leaf driver was parked beside me, and she looked at me indignantly as if to say, you're going to park a Golf in an electric charging point and take up a space that's designed for electric cars, because she did not know it was an electric car. It looked like a perfectly normal Golf. So, you know, if electric car drivers don't recognise another one on the road, how are you going to, you know, promote them to other drivers?
Mm. And that's the challenge facing the manufacturers.
Absolutely.
How far are we behind, or perhaps we're ahead, as it relates to adapting to electric cars here?
We're no faster or slower than anybody else. Now, there has been an increase this year. 310 were sold up to the end of May, which is about 160% of an increase on last year, where only 120 were sold. But we're still way off the figures they were talking about 5 years ago. You know, they said by 2020, 10% of all cars on the road would be electric. We are nowhere near.
No, I think that was pie in the sky, though, really, wasn't it? Perhaps an unrealistic target.
Yeah, I mean, at this stage, I think price is still the key thing. Mm. As I said, the electric Golf that I tested a couple of weeks ago was absolutely fabulous. Drove like a normal Golf, was obviously incredibly cheap to run, but it was €35,000 to buy.
What is the resale value like? I mean, maybe people hold on to these cars. I'm not sure, as it relates to used cars, how many electric cars are on the market. Is that a factor too? Is the resale value high or low?
Well, the resale value, there's no reason to believe it's any different from any other car. They don't depreciate any quicker. In some ways, there might be a better demand for second-hand electric cars because there's so few of them around. The value of them should actually be higher. But again, I think it's just... it's one of these catch-22s. We need more of them on the road. You need to know that, oh, my neighbour has one, or there's one across the road, or the guy I work with has one, before other people will take a chance. There's just too few of them. Also, not all car dealers or car manufacturers have an electric car in their range. So it's not like every dealership you go into, there's an electric car there.
True. Now, generally, motoring in general, locally here, car sales people are enjoying an increase in car sales that's reflected right across the country. We're pretty close to the 152 plate now, aren't we?
We are, which is coming in next week. So for the 152, it is actually in some ways a very good time to buy a car, and it's almost a better time than 151.
Tell us why.
Mainly because we're still conditioned to buy cars at the beginning of the year, so people like the 1.5 plate, whether it's one or two, to get the entire year out of it. And even though we have the split registration, and this is the third year, it's still... The bulk of the sales are still done at the start of the year. So car manufacturers and dealers really have to tempt you into the showrooms in July. So there's some great offers out there at the moment. The scrappage deals are the big thing at the moment. For example, if you trade in an old car, any old car or van with Nissan, they will give you a minimum of €4,000 towards a new Nissan.
Is that a genuine saving, Geraldine? I'm a bit cynical about these things, not just as it relates to car dealerships and what have you, but are you getting a genuine discount?
Well, you are, in the sense that they're all competing against each other. As I said, this is the thing. So if you look at, if you take those scrappage deals, you've got Hyundai, Nissan, Opel, Peugeot and Toyota all offering those. So if you're going to buy a brand new car from any of those, then now is the time to avail. Like 4,000 or 4,500 on some of them is a lot to take off a new car.
And you may not see that in January.
No, you won't see that in January. See, that's the thing. People just drift into their car dealerships anyway in January and February. Yeah. But come July, they have to make that special effort to get you in. Now, if you're not, you know, there's other deals out there apart from the scrappage deals. The likes of... Suzuki have a very innovative one. They give you free fuel. If you buy, I think it's their new Solario, you get 5,000 kilometres worth of free fuel. Or if you buy their Swift or S-Cross, you get 10,000. Others are offering free servicing. Citroen are offering, I think it's 3 years free servicing. Hyundai are offering 5. And Toyota, again, you can either avail of the scrappage or 3 years free servicing. So, like, they are really going out of their way to get your business at this time of the year in a much more aggressive way than they do at the beginning of the year.
So if you're on the market, put your old notions away and go out and get a 152 plate and save yourself some money.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as I said, they really are. There's much better deals to be had at this time of the year. And even small things that they will just throw in, like BMW are throwing in complimentary leather on a range of their models in this year. You could buy exactly the same cars, pay exactly the same price for a BMW in one of their particular models in July than you would have in June. But this time you get free leather. And leather is like, it's an expensive extra.
Yeah.
So it's a nice one to get thrown, you know, to get in. So.
And I presume then if you change your car maybe in 2 or 3 years, you know, and you're looking to sell it on the second-hand market, the saving you made on the 152151. In other words, at that stage, it'll be irrelevant when you bought it. You'll just have made the saving.
The resale values on, say, 151 to 152 are negligible at this stage. You know, you're not going to make a huge difference. Obviously, if you traded it next year, you will. But
yeah,
say 2-3 years down the line, it's practically gone. So that saving is huge.
Now, one final thing, Geraldine. The Minister for Finance, I think, poo-pooed the idea of personal number plates, said there's not wouldn't be a demand for how much it would cost to set up. Is there a demand for it? Is that something you'd be interested in?
I don't think there is. It's a huge thing in the UK, but I mean, I think we're still getting to grips with the, you know, the dual registration. If we met on the floor with the personal, with registration plates, we'll be completely confused. So no, I don't think it's something the industry would be particularly looking for either.
All right, GH1, you're not going to... We could share that one, actually. Greg Hughes and Geraldine Herbert, we could share that one.
You could have it for 152 and I could have it for 151.
Sounds fantastic. Geraldine, always a pleasure. We can check you out to your website, Motoring Wheels for Women, and we can read you too in the Indo and Irish Country magazine.
That's it, Greg.
Superb, Geraldine. God bless you. Thank you so much. That's Geraldine Herbert. Okay, next up on the programme, we've read this week that gossiping is what makes us human. This is according to an Oxford professor, indeed a professor of evolutionary psychology, and he joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Professor Robin Dunbar.
Good morning.
So gossiping allows us to pass on vital information about who to trust and helps us bond with family and friends. This is at odds to what I was taught about gossiping.
Well, I guess we sort of do use the word in two different ways. There is a tendency to see gossip as kind of just malicious, behind your back sort of stuff. But actually, that's a relatively recent usage of the term. The term is actually much more general and refers to sort of what you do when you hang over the garden fence chatting to your neighbour. So it really is about sort of keeping your relationships going and building them and so on.
And that's healthy, isn't it? Chewing the breeze, isn't that what they say?
Yeah, exactly. But this is not to say that it doesn't get used in a malicious way. And to be fair, you know, we need to keep check on what everybody's up to make sure they're not misbehaving completely.
So say, for instance, myself and yourself, Robin, are having a chat about a third party who's out of earshot. Now, I'm not saying anything about them which is malicious, but I'm warning you that perhaps you shouldn't trust this person or this person did this on me or did that on me. That healthy gossip?
Well, it in the sense that the problem we have to deal with in real life is keeping your kind of social network within which you're embedded kind of working efficiently and up to date. So you've got to know what's going on, who's fallen out with who or whatever, but also who's kind of not pulling their weight in the community, if you like. And, you know, particularly in small communities, that's really important. And we can only find this kind of information out by sort of conversation and so on. But at the end of the day, the really important bit of this is the quality of your social network and its size, the number of friends and family you have, has a massive effect on your health and well-being and your general sort of ability to cope with life.
You talk about the word gossip having a new meaning now, and you use the phrase social network, which also has a new meaning now. Is actual face-to-face human interaction more important now, given the fact that so many of us seem to do most of our socialising to a screen?
Well, speak for yourself. In reality, in fact, we don't have a bigger social network online than we do in the face-to-face world. And most people's social networks are the people they kind of see and want to keep in touch with anyway. And, Facebook or social media are just a very convenient way of doing that, particularly with people you can't see very often. But it really is, in the end, important that you do see them face to face. You've got to see the whites of their eyes now and again, because if you don't, even Facebook won't stop that relationship sort of gradually sliding off the edge of your social world.
And you say, to speak for myself, I will have to put my hands up and say, while not malicious, I'm probably one of the biggest gossips you've spoken to. So, taking on board your advice, how do we employ it then to improve our social network and improve our knowledge of our community? Talk more simply?
Well, I think you just, as they say, you just need to get out more. I mean, you know, one of the things we've lost, I guess, in the modern world is those sort of focal centres of the community, like the pub, the village pub, and, you know, the evening dances in the village hall, where you actually, you know, go out there and meet people and interact with them. And we have tended to become much more sort of housebound in a way.
How do you see that evolving if you can look forward 10, 20, 30 years? Is it peaking? Will we come to this mass realization that we aren't speaking enough to each other, as you say, face to face, looking into the whites of each other's eyes? Or is it going to get worse in that there'll be less actual interaction amongst humans?
Well, I sincerely hope there won't be less, because we'll be in deep shtuck if that's the case, I suspect. What makes the world go round and work well in the end is talking to each other. Excuse me. If, you know, I think in the end people are so driven to be social that, you know, no amount of electronic media in the end is going to make you as happy with your social life as actually being able to get out there and just sit around the fire and have a pint or whatever.
Okay, very interesting indeed. Professor Robin Dunbar, Professor of Evolutionary Psychology at Oxford University, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Okay, next up on the programme, we are discussing Airbnb. What is it? Well, it's a home sharing site which has fans right across the world. And it's been covered recently on thejournal.ie. Journalist with that organisation is Peter Bodkin. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you going there, Greg?
Very well indeed. So tell us about Airbnb. What is it?
Well, as you mentioned, it's a home sharing site. So it's somewhere where people can book anything from a bed in a shared room to a room in a shared house to an entire property anywhere around the world. There's over 1,000 active rentals in Ireland alone at the moment, covering the whole country. So, you know, really it's a way to make a bit more money, I guess, off your property if you're renting it out, or it's a way to get a different kind of travel experience if you're a traveller.
And as it relates to, you know, ensuring property's up to a certain standard, or you're not staying with an axe murderer, what are the checks and balances in that regard?
Well, this is one of the issues that's come up, not only with this service, but a lot of other what we call peer-to-peer services appearing now, like Uber for taxi rides, for instance. A lot of the onus here falls onto the users. These platforms kind of see themselves as being just a liaison between two people who are offering each other services. So when it comes to not staying with an axe murderer, as you mentioned, there isn't a lot that these companies do to protect you. The system basically works on trust and a review system, so you can look at the feedback that previous guests, for instance, if you're a host, have got, or hosts have got if you're a guest, and based on that you can try and work out as best you can if they're going to be a good person to stay with or a good person to have in your home.
If someone visits Ireland and stays in a B&B or a hotel, there are, you know, if they were to fall or something, there is insurance there and other checks and balances to ensure fire safety, loads of other different types of things. But still, people are prepared for that different experience, or perhaps to save a few quid to bypass that and use this sort of Airbnb option.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a great service. I, for one, have used it many times, travelled halfway around Europe using it and had some fantastic experiences. But particularly from a host point of view, there's a few things you want to watch out for, because Airbnb, at least outside the US, doesn't come with any insurance cover. So it's recommended by the organisation itself that people do look at their own insurance, you know, something like a homeowner's insurance or even a renter's insurance. But the other thing to be careful of there is often these policies don't as standard cover renting out your property as an Airbnb. So if you do have something go wrong, you're not necessarily protected. And there, it really pays to check with your insurer what their policies are, and at the very least, make sure they're notified of what you're doing with your property so that you don't void any insurance you've already got.
Exactly, because there's that grey area, presumed, between a private residential property and a commercial property.
Exactly. There is a grey area there, and it's one which hasn't really been teased out a lot. I mean, when you look at these companies like Airbnb or Uber that I mentioned earlier, they're very new. Airbnb's only been around for 7 years, and really it's only taken off in the last few. So a lot of those issues about where exactly its responsibility ends and the responsibility of the users start haven't fully been teased out yet.
Well, I suppose as their popularity grows, their profit grows, they've seen this themselves as a problem. They've, in the US, Airbnb have launched their own $1 million host protection insurance, which I presume will be rolled out around the world where it's possible to make sure that the whole notion doesn't stall and start retracting on them.
Yeah, we've asked the company about this, and they've said they're looking at it, but no time frame has been put on that. And given that it was only launched in the US in January, I think it's fairly safe to say that it's not going to be happening any time in the immediate future. So it, as I said before, really falls to the homeowner at the moment, or the renter who's looking to make a bit of extra cash out of their property, to make sure that they've got themselves protected as much as possible.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, 1,000 active rentals in Ireland. It's here, and we'll see how it develops from there. Just from your own perspective, Peter, you mentioned you travelled around Europe using Airbnb or a similar service at the very least. No negative experiences?
No negative experiences. And I think it has to be said that they are a very rare occurrence. You know, there are reports coming out of a few places in the US, for instance, one case where a landlord was left on the hook for about $10,000 in damages that only surfaced after guests had left, so there was no real way to recover that money from the company or the guests. But those kind of experiences are few and far between, and particularly for the guests. You can get access to some fantastic properties that otherwise, you know, you'd be digging around or just wouldn't be available to you before a service like this became widely used.
I'm sure there's people listening who've had relations stay over and left similar kind of damage when they left. So it's not just the likes of Airbnb. We'll see how it gets on, Peter. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and thanks so much for coming on the program with us.
Anytime, thank you.
All right, thank you. That's Peter Bodkin, who's a journalist with thejournal.ie. So that's where we have to leave it. Thank you very much to all of you who listened and contributed to the programme. Hope you enjoyed it. It'll be online for you if you missed any of it in the next half an hour or so. We'll be back with you next Saturday between 10 and 12, and I'll chat to you at the news desk during the week. For me, Greg Hughes, and producer Yvonne McFadden, have a fantastic weekend.